Thank you, Anne, and thanks for the opportunity from CEDA to come here and talk to you. Future of work in the era of the robots. Well, we're hearing some interesting things about current statistics around the way in which the nature of work is changing. What's very clear, and I think I'm pressing the wrong button. Just press that one. No. There we go. What's very, very clear from what we're hearing, and I often open with this expression, the world has never changed so fast. And, you know, we just have to think about our own childhoods and think about the way the world is different now. And then I am, you know, challenged by a colleague of mine who was complaining yesterday because their five-year-old at school is asking for their first smartphone because all the other kids at school have got them. Remember, smartphones have only been here for 12 years. You know, Twitter and the, you know, the kinds of things we're doing with Instagram, et cetera, is less than 10 years old. The world has never changed so fast. But, and this is even more sobering, delay. Oh, now I go too fast. This is like one of those games you have to play, and you know, I'm not very good at it. It will never be this slow again. So we're moving into an era of what we call an era of exponentiality, and this is what's worrying people most. Speed of change and the fact that change is coming has always been something that we've had to deal with, particularly in the shift from an agricultural economy into the Industrial Revolution and so on. And people are always worried about jobs going and not being able to cope. But culture has been able to kind of catch up because there's a significant enough lag between the new technologies and the way they've impacted the whole of culture. The worry now is that actually the growth is exponential. It's really fast. So a lot of people are getting very stressed. So typically one in two people are fearful of losing their jobs. I mean, it was a nice story about the guy who, you know, got a job going around reading the meters. But the only reason that job still exists is because the cost of the infrastructure to develop an Internet of Things to have meter reading totally automated is still higher than the cost of employing somebody to walk around the streets. And the moment that changes, that job goes. So lovely as it is that we think people need these jobs and the opportunity we have to give them, you know, we're seeing that change. I mean, I was sobered by an investigation into putting RFID tags into these big 40-foot containers that were travelling around the world multiple times, transporting goods five or six times around the world between when, you know, the cotton was picked to when it was turned into cloth to when it was fabricated into a shirt to when it was embroidered to when the buttons were put on in about five different countries. And because you're transporting tens of thousands of items, hundreds of thousands of items in one container, the unit cost per shirt was still tiny to ship them around the world to the cheapest place do the next job in the production line. But the interesting thing was, where were the containers made? Well, the containers were made in China, because that was still the cheapest place to make them. But where were they painted? I was really surprised to find out where they were painted. They were shipped to another country to be painted, because it was still cheaper to ship them to get them painted somewhere else. And what was that country? It was the USA, because it was totally robotic. And it was cheaper to ship them straight across the Pacific into Los Angeles and get them painted, and then fill them with stuff and carry on shipping them around. As soon as the infrastructure is available to automate those jobs disappear. And we will move things around to the cheapest point at which we can produce our production. In fact, the stock market invests in companies that have what we call a higher market capitalization per employee. What is the total revenue of the company divided by the number of employees? Because that's where profitability is. So a big organization like Walmart might have massive revenues, but it employs millions of people. Company like Instagram has nearly as big of revenues, but it employs less than 100 people. That's what's driving the stock exchange. That's what's driving investment. So this is coming, and it's coming now. So we do have some real reasons to be worried. So this era of exponentiality, just in case you don't get what it is, there's a little quiz, because you know, this is about education, and you're going to get your dinner, so we're going to make sure that you've earned it. So let's ask what exponentiality means. So I've got a question for you. The area of a pond covered by lily pads has lily pads double every day. Frog lives on this pond, dives in the pond, gets his food, has a lovely time, but as soon as the lily pond is covered by lily pads, it's no longer tenable for him to live there. On day 19, the pond is half covered. So on what day is the pond completely covered in lily pads? It's a rhetorical question, because you're all very clever and you don't need me to ask you what the answer is. It's day 20. This is the fear about exponentiality. The speed of change accelerates. And by the time something is happening and you realize it's happening, it's too late to do something about it. So this is the problem we have. And the problem people have the fear about with things like artificial intelligence. Suddenly the jobs have gone. Suddenly the industry is no longer tenable. Suddenly that business disappears. Suddenly the jobs disappear. Because it happens so fast that we're not able to deal with the rapidity of that change. How does this affect the world of work? How does this affect what we are going to do? How is it going to change my future and my career prospects? Well, it's changing because organizations are fundamentally changing. And I gave you the example of the market capitalization. Businesses are moving from people organizations where you followed processes that were supported by technology. And technology over the last 20, 30 years has become an important aspect of trying to make a people-driven organization more efficient. What you're now seeing is the growth of businesses that are technology businesses that are driving processes supported by less and less people. Software is changing the world. And if we can get software to do the job, it becomes extremely efficient, and people are there simply to innovate around the use of software. This is what we talk about disruption all the time. We use that word. We all think we understand it. Disruption occurs when a new player comes into a market where they don't need the investment in infrastructure. They don't need to have a bank in the high street. They don't need to have a fleet of taxis. They don't need to have a record-producing company or a business that can make CDs. But they meet an unmet consumer demand where they're dissatisfied with the current service. But previously, nobody could come in and disrupt that business or industry. Software enables you to do it. I don't need cars to create a ride-sharing service. I can create Uber. Uber is a software company. I don't need for you to go and buy a CD, so I don't need to have a company that presses CDs and makes CDs and have contracts with the musicians. I can just stream the music you want, when you want, how you want it. You don't have to buy it, just pay to listen to it. So software is disruptive. It is software that's changing the way the world works. And so this is what we've got to be very careful about, because it means that we are looking at jobs that don't yet exist, using technologies that haven't yet been invented to solve problems we haven't even identified. So looking at these projections, you know, all very well and very interesting, the stuff that my colleagues and people at Deloitte and KPMG and McKinsey and everybody else does, absolutely fantastic, because we don't have crystal balls. It's very difficult to predict what's going to happen. So very, very useful. But yet we are preparing for the unknown. And this is what is so frightening for a lot of people. And frightening for whole countries. Singapore is investing heavily in how it's going to deal with a huge number of people in Singapore who are not going to be skilled for the next generation of jobs. So it's aware of this need to change this. So the future of work, as we've already heard a little bit about, and that's why I think there's going to be some really interesting combinations of what's going on in the TAFE sector as well as the university sector as well as outside those sectors, is that the future of work is about skills and not just about qualifications and knowledge. Because the interesting thing about our previous view of work is that you were either unskilled or you were skilled in a trade and you went to a TAFE, or you were a knowledge worker and you went to university. Well, the two groups most at threat are the unskilled, who are doing jobs that are highly repetitive that the robots can do, and the knowledge worker. Because the knowledge worker is fundamentally the middle part of a supply chain of information. I go to university, I learn my discipline, I understand my subject, I know how to look at all the content, all the material, I learn it all, I become an expert on it. Then when you come to me and ask for some service, either you want some advice about finances and mortgages, or you want to understand some other aspect of very complex information, I translate it for you. We now have computers that can read ordinary language. They don't just read databases and data cubes of information in rows and columns. They can read ordinary English. You use them all the time. Google is just such a form of artificial intelligence. But you use Siri, you use Google Now and so on to actually talk in English language and get answers, because it can read documentation millions of times faster than you can read it. And it can read unstructured documentation. It can read Word documents, PDF files. It can scan images and so on. So all those things that knowledge workers did will be done by the robots. So what are the skills? Well, recruitment's very much going to change around finding talent. And this is something I'm sure Nate's going to talk about in a moment. This is the hardest job for every single organization. Talent at the moment, the right talents in these right skills, are actually what's holding things back. Once you start to be able to produce the talent you need, you will see that exponential change accelerate even more. So we've got to look at how you find the talent for these jobs, because technology in the labor market are changing at a record pace. We now see the need for what we call liquid skills, skills that flow from one type of project or one type of requirement to another. We need these nano skills. Jobs are now becoming hybrid jobs. You don't just need technical information about a particular sphere or domain. You need to understand data science. You need to understand predictive analytics. You need to understand what an API is and the API economy. You need to understand cloud computing. You need to understand all these things to bring them together. We need these T-shaped individuals you keep hearing us talk about. And then we've got the rise of teams. Experts can be located anywhere. And in fact, young people are suggesting the preference for not wanting to be stuck in one location. The cost of housing is so great. Why do I want to try to base myself there? And you know what? With a gig economy, I want to work for 6 months on a contract and then go and surf for 3 months or go on holiday for a year traveling around the world and then come back and get another job. And because they're being told there's no career prospect for them, there's no long-term job within one industry, they're saying, well, I'll just go and do the same job in a different company and have the experience. And for 10 years, I'll just kind of move around and do what I want to do. This gig economy is changing the whole way in which talent is moving around and is obtainable in different ways. So the challenge is universal. It's a challenge for industry because there's an overall shortage of qualified people for the jobs, people with the skills and people with the experience. It's also a challenge for the professions and professionals because they're under constant pressure. We don't have time to train people and educate people for those new skills and requirements. It's a challenge for academic institutions on two counts. One is it's very difficult for academic institutions to have the kinds of skills and people they need to actually talk about what industry demands. You know, I get this complaint all the time, from heads of school. The trouble is I've got staff who've been teaching the same thing for 20 years with the textbook they wrote 20 years ago, and they actually haven't had any work experience and don't know how to teach all this new stuff. That's very difficult how you even deal with that in a higher education institution. And then, of course, they're struggling to keep pace with technology and the requirements of industry around them. And students, they've got trouble defining a career path. We're having trouble in the accounting profession because parents are hearing robots will do the jobs, there won't be accountants. They're hearing noise from the big four employers, the KPMGs and EYs and Deloitte's and everything else, that they don't need to hire accountants anymore. They need to hire people with technology skills and they can train them to be accountants. They don't need to have a good degree in accounting. So young people are failing to understand what I'm going to do. Previously, I just got a degree and I got a job. Now they're reading newspapers saying degree doesn't mean anything. Look at the hundreds of thousands of people who've got degrees still can't get jobs. They get a master's degree, still can't get a job. I know the statistics seem to say that isn't the case, but you just have to listen to what's going on around you. So we need to take this sort of future now approach. So we've got a whole new range of employee profiles, which is a focus on skills as a prerequisite, not necessarily the degrees that are earned. And we need to look at non-traditional candidates with diverse backgrounds and skill sets. And Anne was talking a little bit about those kinds of requirements. And we need that continuous drive for lifelong learning and growth. And that's a real change to the way we view education. We can no longer view education as these three blocks, in the primary school, secondary school, tertiary education. It's going to need to be positioning of a continuous lifelong stream of learning engaged with work. What that means for four-year degrees, postgraduate degrees, I think is going to be something that's very, very significant over the next 5 to 10 years as to whether universities are able to adapt to the requirement for a very different kind of approach to learning. They're doing it, and they're trying very hard to do that, but there's some interesting challenges ahead because of the way they're set up. So it's new types of roles that we've got to focus on, and even new partnerships between those different education providers and industry and so on to prepare us for this future. And then finally, that workforce strategy demands agility, and that's why I think it's going to be fantastic now to have Nate on stage talking about the startup world and the way in which lifelong learning is going to be absolutely essential in meeting the needs of technology in society, because we've got to understand how we define career paths for young people, how we keep them engaged with their learning continuously, and we no longer focus on those degrees. Because we're seeing people doing what we call arbitraging their education, not necessarily in Australia, but certainly in the subcontinent, Indian subcontinent, Southeast Asia. We're seeing students say, you know what, I'm going to do an online degree from here, and I'm going to get some certificates from over there, and I'm then going to actually invest in a bit of postgraduate education there, because then I've got a resume that looks very different and differentiated from somebody else, and I've spent $30,000 instead of $100,000. So the smart students are beginning to do that. They're beginning to say, how do I build my education and learning portfolio that makes me look different in this world where everybody has been looking the same? So with that, I'd like to welcome Nate Sirk to the stage, who I'm just going to tell you far more about what this means in detail. Thanks.